This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. And as ever, I'm here with Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm great, Parv. I'm really excited to get the questions of this episode on and see how we get on. I just want to mention before that, if anyone wants to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us, how do they do that, Parv? Because I think getting iTunes comments really helps the show.
Yeah, so if you search for PWOPTBN, or indeed just for Letters from Kayfabe in iTunes, the feed should come up and, you know, leave us a 5-star review. you know, it doesn't have to be 5-star, but I think that the 5-star ones help. So yes, I mean, that said, we've had the feed going for as long as we have, and I'm not sure how many, we still haven't come up. I still haven't seen any reviews on there, but we do seem to get a lot of people listening. So,
well, sort it out, guys, and get some reviews on there. We would appreciate it. And also tell a friend. As silly as it sounds, the best way of getting the word out about this podcast is literally telling people. If you know anyone you work with or anyone in your family that are ex-WWF fans, they might dig this podcast. Just let them know about it.
Absolutely. Okay, well, shall we go to the mailbag?
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Then we'll kick this one off. This question's in from Jason Weber in Fall River, Massachusetts. And Jason asks, Dear Alan and Parv, who or what was the mariner who kept attacking Earthquake in July of 1991? So, who was the mariner, Parv?
Well, the Mariner was this kind of bizarre masked figure who kept on for a very short spell in 1991, had a number of different appearances where he would randomly attack people, especially he had seemed to have a special interest in Earthquake. And I think he has maybe three or four different appearances that I saw. Where he attacks Earthquake and then basically runs off. Now, Alan, I have to ask you, were you aware of this before we did the show, this Mariner thing? Because it wasn't something that was on my radar.
No, I had heard about it before. I'd actually heard about it quite far back. I think, if memory serves me right, there was I think it was Inside Wrestling at the end of 1993. They had a Hogan and Beefcake versus Sting and Bulldog Fantasy Dream match. And one of the pictures was a still of a masked man beating up Martel. And it was basically explaining that Beefcake used to hide behind the gear or something along that, you know, along that nature. So I kind of did know about it vaguely, but it kind of rejog my memory kind of going through this at the time. But the thing is, the name, the Mariner, that he's referred to a lot by people, that was never the name he was ever given. He was never actually acknowledged with the name on TV. So this name, the Mariner or the Avenger, that was apparently eventually going to become his name, I heard.
Yeah, well, he's not referred to. He's only referred to as, who is this guy, basically. And in fact, the Jason's exact dating is a little bit off there. Because it's more towards February, March sort of time of 91. And I think there's basically four different attacks that he has. And it's around the time that Greg Valentine is feuding with Jimmy Hart, of which Earthquake is part of it. So if you remember, Greg Valentine had a match with Earthquake at WrestleMania that year.
Yeah.
This was kind of in the run-up to that. But basically, after the March 23, 1991, we don't really see the Mariner or whatever you call him again. So it's like one of those strange things that happened for about a month and then was disappeared and never heard of or mentioned again. I think you alluded to who exactly this was, Alan, didn't you?
Yes, it was the one and only man of a thousand gimmicks, Brutus Beefcake, under the hood. And the gimmick was was basically supposed to be with him under a hood because he was pretty banged up still from his parasailing accident he had in the summer of 1990. So he was still banged up, so they put him under a hood because of that reason. And the gimmick was dropped because apparently they decided to be cautious and pull back on the idea in fear that he might injure himself again. So he kind of disappeared, and he parlayed himself into the barbershop, didn't he, just after this. I mean, that segment debuted, it was the 14th of April 1991 edition of Superstars. So the Mariner, or whoever he was called, Furface was another name for him, but that was Scott Keith on RSPW who came up with that name, and it kind of stuck. But he was only around from like January, February time. Then there was he disappeared as soon as he, you know, quite quickly.
Yeah, kind of strange. And then the barbershop, of course, would be a fixture, the kind of B show, talk show, wouldn't it, on Challenge until. I mean, well, maybe we'll come back to the barbershop on a future episode, Alan. But I definitely think it's worth kind of tracking down and watching the Mariner stuff if you haven't seen it, just because it's so. I don't know. It's so random, really. It's like an angle that doesn't go anywhere, and as far as I know, nothing ever came of it either. They didn't mention it at WrestleMania or.
No, I believe the plan was for him to eventually be unmasked and feud with Earthquake, which would have been sort of upper mid-card feud. But as I alluded to, they decided to pull back on it because of his face hadn't fully healed. He was quite banged up. I've never seen any pictures of him around that time, but I can imagine if someone's knees smashed into his face who was paragliding while he was walking along the beach, it wouldn't have been a pretty sight at all.
This has just occurred to me. I wonder if one of the things that they may have been teasing was a Dream Team reunion between Greg and Beefcake on the face side, because of course they were with Jimmy Hart at one time, and Beefcake and Valentine used to tag, and you know, Mariner's helping out Valentine, so maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, it wasn't a feud that would, really set the gates on fire. But, it's filler for people. And, you know, any promotion or any show needs that sort of stuff as well as the main event things.
Okay. Why don't we go to the next question then?
Okay. The next question is, Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler is Nikolai Volkov. Can you tell me more about him becoming a member of the Million Dollar Corporation in 1994? And I'll give you one guess who this question's from, Parv.
Is it Chadley Criscolo from Norfolk, Connecticut?
That one and the same. Chadley, we've now gone to Nikolai Volkov. We're now on show 7, and, you know, you've moved. I don't know how far down you've gone now with Nikolai Volkov. Never one of my favourite workers anyway, but more about the question, Parv. Can you tell me a bit more about Nikolai Volkov and what he was doing around this time?
Okay, well, I actually went back and watched this not the entire run, but certainly the initial angle and a fair few of the matches, which I put on the this week's playlist. Essentially what happens is that Nikolai Volkov is down on his luck in 1994. He's made some bad investments. And I actually thought, Alan, that this was quite an interesting kind of social commentary on the kind of plight of former Eastern Bloc individuals after the Fort Berlin Wall had come down. It was kind of, you know, it's like, well, if you know anything about the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, there were some people who did very well out of it, like Roman Abramovich or, you know, various other oligarchs who made billions. And then there were kind of people who didn't do so well out of it. And seemingly Nikolai was one of them.
he was down on his luck in 1994. That was for certain, and he was looking for work. I mean, looking at his results here, his first time he appeared back in 1994 was against Dwayne Gill on Superstars. But the first time this kind of angle kicked off was the Monday Night Raw, the 25th of April of 1994, where he comes on the King's Court.
That's right. Yes.
And at this point, he's 46 years of age, is Nikolai Volkov. Would you put him any older or any younger?
He was definitely north of 40, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But I mean, Nikolai, the thing is about Nikolai is that he was even old when he was tagging with Iron Sheik. Because, I mean, he was Beppo Mongol back in 1970. Don't forget.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long old career.
It sure is.
And, I don't know if you went back and watched any of this stuff, Alan, but his brown suit on that initial appearance on, I mean, they picked the perfect suit for him, didn't they?
Oh God, it was horrible. It was something out of the 1970s, wasn't it? Like something he bought from a charity shop on that first King's Court episode. And on the episode, he admits he's basically got no money, but he has his health and he's happy. And Lawler just is brutal. Really, really goes to town insulting him, getting in some funny insults. But Vince as well, there's a bit of thing I noticed here. Vince gets his jollies, I think, playing off a real life situation, throughout the commentary, even if it was ultimately doing him a favour by giving him a job. But the one question I want to ask you, Parv, is if Nikolai Volkov was so down on his luck, how could he afford those ringside seats for Raw? You know, at this time, he was turning up on Raw, wasn't he? Just sitting in the crowd looking for a job. So, you know, for someone that was so poor, he managed to land himself some sweet ringside seats. Maybe they were comps. You know, they were trying to paper the venues at the time, and maybe he got a comp ticket. I don't know.
Or maybe they were being paid for by someone who's quite famous for buying ringside seats. Which brings us to our next edition of the King's Court, of course, where Ted DiBiase turns up. What happens here? Did you see
This is a couple of weeks later. So DiBiase announces that Nikolai Volkov is his latest purchase, and Ted calls out Nikolai for his Russian flag jacket being out of date, which I thought was quite funny, really. You know, the jacket that he wore with the US and Russian flag.
He mocks the flag being out of date, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're really going to town on that, which I thought was a nice touch. And they forced Volkov to wear new tights that say on the back of it, Property of the Million Dollar Man. And they had a cent sign on the side instead of a dollar sign, which I thought was quite funny. It was basically a play that Million Dollar Man had the dollar sign, and Volkov was didn't have that much money. And Vince basically said that Nikolai Volkov once was a proud weightlifter, and he actually mentioned Mark Henry in the same sentence as that, which I thought was quite interesting.
I rewound that and actually was like, was that Mark? Is that Mark Henry that they mentioned in 1991? I thought it was 1994. Yeah,
it was Mark Henry. So obviously they had eyes on him even back then, and he came into the WWF in 96, didn't he? I think he's made his debut at In Your House 10 in the September against Lawler. Funnily enough, now we're mentioning him.
But yeah, weirdly, they always put over during this time. I noticed Volkov's history as a kind of power lifter. And Volkov's history as a former European champion, but they don't mention his tag titles at all, which I find is strange, because they put over those two things consistently in all of these all of his matches during this time, but they don't put over his his actual WWF titles that he had.
His accomplishments. So how do you think he went on in 1994 then, Paul? Well, I mean, what else was he doing?
Well, first of all, I have to mention that this is really quite a brutal angle, isn't it? I mean, how harsh is DiBiase to... I mean, Lawler's bad enough in the week before, but then, Ted basically wants to treat him like a glorified slave at this point. I mean, it's kind of sick, isn't it? I actually thought it was sadistic, you know?
That was what they were playing for, but I think it fell a little bit flat to the live audience on that, you know, that edition where he makes him his latest purchase. And I think, was he the first signing of the Million Dollar Corporation or the second?
I was trying to think. See, I want to say maybe that IRS was kind of around as well. Maybe IRS was his first guy. Like, he already had the money in connection with him. But he was definitely very early on, because Ted had been doing a few commentary things here and there in early 94. So Volkov's one of the first members of the corporation, for sure. And, I mean, it's kind of like, he really seems like he wants to humiliate Nikolai. And Nikolai's like, well, I hate you, but I need the money. That's how they play it. So it's kind of a little bit confusing in wrestling terms, because, well, are we meant to root for Nikolai here, a man being humiliated, or are we meant to dislike him because he's working for DiBiase?
Well, yeah, it was played like that, wasn't it, a little bit? And his first match on Raw was against Matt Hardy, which was the 23rd of May.
I watched that,
And then he went on and he was on Superstars, where he got beat by DQ by Mabel. And then after that, he went on and had a little bit of a feud after the 1-2-3 Kid beat him. He went on to beat him Virgil around the horn, which is quite interesting. I think that was his feud on the road, which I would imagine wouldn't have been that great in 94.
Well, it's almost like the kind of the old Virgil versus the new Virgil, in a, I guess, in a way, like the, you know, you could see it like Virgil is trying to worm his way back into Ted's affections by showing him that he's, you know, still got it.
Oh yeah, I mean, just think about this though. Nikolai Volkov, as in a kayfabe world, as a talent, must have been pretty shit in 1994 because he wouldn't get hired by Jack Tunney or Eric Bischoff for either WWF or WCW as a talent, and he had to go and beg DiBiase or go to DiBiase for work instead. And you know, the one thing about Ted, he was quite fair, to be honest. When he hired his people, he'd hire people like Native Americans, he didn't show any bias, blokes with tattoos on the heads, UFC fighters who dabbled in voodoo, you know, that kind of people. And he only had to dress up as the Undertaker, and he'd you know, he'd sign you up straight away for a feud, and without even seeing your CV. So I've no idea what Volkov was actually complaining about. A job is a job at the end of the day, and Ted seemed like a fair man to me.
No, one of the things I couldn't help notice about Volkov during this run is that he actually worked like a fair bit more technically than we're used to. Like I noticed he threw in a butterfly suplex in virtually all of these matches, which is, I mean, do you remember Volkov doing a butterfly suplex in his kind of 80s days?
No, I don't know what he, I mean.
He was more kind of punch and kick clubber type guy, wasn't he? So, It was just interesting that he, under the tutelage of Ted, he seemed to become a bit more technical.
which was awesome to see. I mean, the run didn't last all that long. He petered out on TV. I think his last TV appearance was he lost a $10,000 challenge match. I don't know if you saw this one, Parv, to Tatanka.
Right, yep.
And that was basically the end of him on TV. He did defeat Virgil to win that feud. That was his last TV appearance on Challenge at the start of July. And then after that,
kind of wrestling challenge level feud in July of 94.
And then he goes on and beats Virgil around the horn. And then his last actual appearance is all the way in December of 94. He beats Bob Starr on a house show in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Now, if you were Virgil around this time, would you think that the writing was on the wall when you're losing to Nikolai?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're losing to Nikolai and he's then losing later on to Doink and Adam Bomb, 1-2-3 Kid and Bruiser Mastino, who was kind of new at the time, and they were giving him a push to see if that gimmick worked out, which actually didn't because he turned into Mantar in 95. But, you know, if you're losing to people like that, then, you know, Virgil's good. There's no hope for you as well, Virgil.
And look at old Chadley there. He's jobbed out Virgil too, because he used to be the favourite wrestler of Chadley, and now he's Nikolai's. Now it's Nikolai. So
Virgil.
Even replaced by Chadley.
The interesting thing, though, in general in 94 with the WWF is, you know, they were supposedly pushing the new generation kind of idea. And look who we had in 94. We had Roddy Piper versus Lawler in the summer. We had Ted DiBiase and Nikolai Volkov on TV. And they also rehired the near 40 King Kong Bundy and the Barbarian. So this new generation thing, it wasn't entirely, you know, youngsters getting pushes. There was, you know, guys, you know, in the 40s and upwards on the card as well.
Who was the new generation? It was basically Brett, Sean and Owen, wasn't it? Who?
Yeah, I mean, Brett, who'd been around since, you know, the mid-80s, Sean, who'd been around since 88 full-time, you know, they'd been around for, you know, it's like pushing now someone like Dolph Ziggler as the new generation, who's been on TV now for, you know, nearly 10 years.
Todd Pettengill, of course.
Oh yeah, pushing out with his earring.
To me, he's the face of the new generation, isn't he?
He's a face you don't get tired slapping as well, is our friend Todd. But have you got anything else to talk about with Volkov to answer this question from Chadley?
No, I mean, to me, it's just, it's more, the booking is more interesting to me, where, like, I mean, it seemed like Volkov got more and more evil during the, like, so, for example, that Virgil match. I mean, Volkov, it's quite funny, actually. Ted gets out some money to try to lure Virgil, you know, after his old tricks. And that's what helps Volkov get a German suplex, and he pins Virgil. And then, of course, Volkov puts the $100 bill in Virgil's mouth.
But, brilliant. We're still playing with the feud that's been going on since... for years now.
No.
I mean...
No, get this. Because, like, Ted in 94 is less flash than Ted in 88. I think that's fair enough. that's fair to say. Yeah. Like, he's no longer wearing the fly suit. It's that horrible kind of sparkly jacket he wears. And what's really funny is that Volkov retrieves the $100 bill. Like, they make sure they get that money back out of Virgil's mouth.
Well,
that made me laugh.
No, it's a nice little touch. But we need to thank Chadley for that question. And I'm really excited to see who's his favourite wrestler, hopefully next week.
So, time for one more, I think.
Yeah, I think we've got time for one more. And we've got another one here. This is Dear Alan and Parv. I'm not ashamed to admit that when I first became a fan in late 94, early 95, I was quite the mark for Adam Bomb. What are your thoughts of him as a performer from this period? Was I onto something? Do you think he got a bit of a raw deal, or was I out to lunch on this one? And that's been sent in from Keith Harris, good friend of the show, who sent it on Twitter, and Keith's from England. So what do we make of Adam Bomb around this run, well, Parv?
I'm wondering if he's the brother of the long-time listener Carl Harris.
Well, he might just be. I mean, that's a coincidence. I mean, and also Keith, he doesn't stipulate where he's from. He just says in England. So you got to let us know, Keith. Where do you hail from in England?
Well, one of the things that interested me about Adam Bomb, Alan, was that. Did you remember we pulled up that random card a few weeks ago from Huntington, and Adam Bomb was on the same card as Hulk Hogan?
Yes, that was the kind of bleed period in 93,
yeah.
Wasn't
now,
it?
I was wondering, well, when was Adam Bomb on TV? So I actually just went back to see how he debuted and how he came in. And in fact, his debut match seemed to be against none other than Virgil, from what I could see, May the 30th, 93. And he comes in with Johnny Polo in one of his very, very early appearances, which interested me because I'd always associated Adam Bomb with Harvey Whippleman.
He initially came in with Polo, and then he went to Harvey. The reason he went to Harvey was apparently Harvey had split from Giant Gonzalez, and he wanted to drop a bomb on Giant Gonzalez. And that didn't ever happen, that feud, but that was the kind of the mindset behind it.
Well, I mean, I actually watched quite a lot of Adam Bomb TV kind of squash matches in preparation for this, just to see if he kind of changes basic presentation much. I noticed the Giant Gonzalez babyface turn that happened in October of 93. And you said that never blew off. That never got an official blow off, Alan.
No, that didn't really work. I mean, the thing with Adam Bomb, I thought it was a superb concept for a character. He was this big bloke with great ability. Not great ability, such I would say. He looked to me, as me as a 12-year-old, he had great ability because he was doing kind of clotheslines from the top rope and power moves. And I thought the gimmick was really cool because it was like someone who'd been exposed to radiation as a youngster. And that played, you know, to someone of that age, you know, you think that was a pretty cool character. And, you know, it worked for me at that age. And that's why I thought it was this monster guy, and I really liked him as well as Keith.
Yeah, well, I mean, so he was meant to be a guy who had been exposed to nuclear radiation, and
yes.
Now was kind of had superhuman strength, a bit like, I don't know, Bane from Batman or someone like that, kind of along those lines, where he's kind of stronger than the average man because he's radioactive. Something.
Yeah, I mean, they're not using people on the juice now. They're using people with radiation poisoning, you know, instead. In this time, it was desperate times in 93 for WWF. But as a character, I thought it was quite good. I mean, he was one of those guys, though, as well. He had a name for his fans, the Bomb Squad. I don't know if you remember that. And anyone who gets a name to call the fans, I think, is getting a little bit of a push, at least.
Well, one of the things that I wonder about with Adam Bomb is, it's almost like they introduced him and he had a lot of TV wins, didn't he? But what did he ever, like, do on the pay-per-views? And, like, what did he do on the kind of... What were his memorable angles and things? I can't really remember any, to be honest.
Well, I know that he was in the 93 Survivor Series as part of one of the teams. He was with Diesel, IRS, and Rick Martel, and they were on the losing team against Marty Jannetty, Randy Savage, Razor Ramon, and the 1-2-3 Kid. So that was his pay-per-view, first pay-per-view appearance was in 93. And he had that match against Earthquake, if you remember, at WrestleMania 10 in 94.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yes.
And it was that match that was cut short. It went for about a minute where Earthquake beat Adam Bomb. It was a very short match. And I think it was cut due to time constraints as well as, you know, the 10-man tag from that WrestleMania as well.
There's a number of long matches on that card, isn't there? Like the Savage Brawl and Brett and Owen.
Oh, Brett versus Owen and the ladder match. Yeah. And I don't know if you remember, though, the reason that Adam Bomb was actually on that card, the WrestleMania card, he was replacing Ludwig Borger, who had broke his ankle in January. And they hoped that he'd be ready in time for WrestleMania. And the whole idea was really setting up Quake for a feud with Yokozuna after WrestleMania. And no one's going to believe you've got much chance against the, you know, top heel if you're going to struggle too much with Adam Bomb. So I think that was the kind of mindset behind that one.
I mean, I've noticed here that, for example, by April of 94, he's losing in King of the Ring qualifying match against 1-2-3 Kid in 5 minutes. So I'm guessing that by that point in 94, the kind of big push was over.
He did reappear at the Survivor Series again. And he was a face this time, because I remember he was feuding with Quang. They split from Harvey Wimpleman. I don't know if you remember that at the time.
It's a face Adam Bomb run, okay.
Yep, he turned face, and he was on the team, the Guts and Glory team, which was Adam Bomb, Bart Gunn, Billy Gunn, Lex Luger, and Mabel. And they got beat by the Million Dollar Team, just playing back into that, which was Bam Bam Bigelow, Jimmy Del Rey, King Kong Bundy, Tatanka, and Tom Pritchard. So that's a mid-card Survivor Series tag team match, if I've ever seen one.
Hold on a second. The Million Dollar Team had Jimmy Del Rey and Tom Pritchard on it. Where was IRS, and where was Nikolai Volkov? Why aren't they making the Million Dollar Team lineup?
No, in 94, I don't know. Maybe, you know, Jim Cornette. Well, no, Jim Cornette wasn't dealing with the Heavenly Bodies in 94, this time anyway. So, bit of an odd team there. But looking through his career myself, I preferred him as a heel than I did as a face. I don't know about you, because you don't really remember him as a face, do you?
Well, I mean, he stuck around for quite a long time. I mean, he's still around in, like, June of 95.
Yeah, he does have he hangs around a bit. And as a face, I thought he was a little bit annoying. He tried to overcompensate for having, you know, in my opinion, not much natural charisma, by just being loud. You know, one of those guys just loud for the sake of it, and it looked a little bit forced. But his offense, like we said before, was spectacular. He did these top slingshot clotheslines.
What was his finisher? Like a kind of jackknife, basically, wasn't it? Like a kind of...
Yeah, I think he had a powerbomb of sorts, finisher, because they've obviously been called Adam Bomb. But yeah, I think he was someone that was over to a point, because he looked quite cool. I mean, he had these big goggles on as well. I don't know if you remember that before he came out.
Yep, the big goggles, yeah.
So I think he was an alright character for the time, but he was never anything more than, you know, lower mid card really to me.
Yeah, interesting guy. I mean, as people who have heard one of the other shows I do here on the Place to Be Nation, where the big boys play, I am not a fan of his Nightstalker period in WCW at all. So I guess Adam Bomb is a step up from Nightstalker.
No, definitely. I mean, the Night Stalker thing. Do you remember, I don't know what show it was on, but what stands out to me, I think it was the Starrcade 91 show where he decides to sit up as Vader's about to splash him. I don't know if you remember that, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to kill him. But yeah, he went on after this to Wrestler's Wrath in WCW, then as Brian Clark. He was part of the tag with Brian Adams.
Was that in Raven's Flock, was it, or...?
No, the Wrath was part of the whole Mortis Wrath, Blood Runs Cold thing. And then after that, he had he teamed, didn't he, with Brian Clark when at the end in WCW. I don't know if you remember that team. They were Chronic.
Yeah. They were called, It's kind of, there's a lot of those 90s, kind of mid to late 90s things that all bleed into, because they're all kind of like grungy, punk, you know, that kind of
generic-y, yeah. I do know what you mean, and I think, no, do you think that, like, going back to the Keith's question, do you think he got a bit of a raw deal, Adam Bomb, or do you think where he was fine, and
I feel like for as much wins he got on TV, it feels like he didn't really have any big storylines going on. For a 2-year run, he did nothing as memorable as, for example, Virgil's feud with DiBiase in 91. You'd say that was, like, as much as Virgil hung around, that was something memorable that he was part of. And for Adam Bomb, I don't know what the equivalent would be. What was memorable that he was part of?
Nothing that stood out, you know, hugely at all. He was someone that was along the card. Like I said, I don't think there's really much else to say about him. He was all right, and me as a kid, I thought he was, you know, okay.
I did, one thing I will say is that I did like the visual of the little pipsqueak Harvey Whippleman coming out with a big guy like that. That is effective, I think. And,
But Harvey Whippleman as a manager, though, isn't an effective manager. So I don't know if it tars Adam Bombing at a certain level straight away when, you know, he came in. We didn't come in with him, like we said before, but he got him.
Okay, well, I hope that answered your question. I think probably the both of you are bigger fans of Adam Bomb than I am. But that's because even in 1993, 94, I gravitated towards the more technical wrestlers. You know, so on that team, for example, I would have liked Rick Martel out of that Survivor Series team that you mentioned. So
that's fair enough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it's time now to go over to JT Rosero with this week's Event Center.
Let's take you down to the Event Center.
Thank you, Parv and Alan. JT Rosero here inside the Event Center on Letters from Kayfabe. Thank you all for listening. Hope you're enjoying the discussion. We have a great topic coming up next. And speaking of unique, there's a unique character in the history of the World Wrestling Entertainment / Federation, and he's one of my all-time favorites. So you're going to have to just indulge me here for a moment as we go back 16 years to 1990, looking at the final matches of Akeem. Of course, portrayed by George Gray, he'd come in as the one-man gang, which he had worked in Mid-South and other territories, come into the company in 1987-ish as one-man gang, and then he would hang around until the fall of 1990 under his second guise, that of Akeem, of course managed by Slick. Final television appearance was on Primetime Wrestling October 22nd, where he defeated George Anderson. That was taped back in September 18th, and actually, if you remember last week, we talked about that Saturday's main event that was at the same TV taping that was filmed. Akeem would appear on that Saturday's main event on 10/13, and of course, he was announced for Survivor Series as well as part of Sergeant Slaughter's team, along with the Orient Express. He'd be replaced by Boris Zukov, and that announcement started to leak out in the following weeks. And he had another feud burgeoning, though, too, because there were some televised incidents between him and Saba Simba. And that would have been an interesting feud. And little 9-year-old JT was sitting back in his home in Rhode Island, excited about that feud. Big Akeem fan, Saba Simba seemed like a natural thing in my mind. The two guys from Africa, of course, I didn't know any better. But Saba Simba showed up in an inset promo on an episode of Challenge on 10/14, Akeem was battling Scott Colton, and Saba Simba said, "Hey, Akeem, you're not from Africa, and I'm going to prove it." And then we got a little bit back and forth between the two of them. But unfortunately, we never get to see the conclusion of that hot feud because Akeem, George Gray, left the company with just issues, I think, over contracts and just wanted to change. He had a fading role in his company at the time. His last high-profile match was back at WrestleMania 6 when he lost a blow-off to the Twin Towers split to the Big Boss Man. He worked the house show circuit into October and then eventually replaced by the one and only Barry O for a couple of turns. Looks like his actual last in-ring match was on October 21st from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he lost to Jim Duggan. And that was it until he showed up in 2001 in the Gimmick Battle Royal at WrestleMania 17. But he wasn't done in the ring. He would head to WCW, worked the indies a little bit, and actually didn't retire until 2000-ish. Lost a lot of weight. He had a heart attack, was making sporadic appearances even into the late 2000s, whether it was Shikara or other independent promotions. Currently, or would work as a prison guard until a back problem forced him to quit. So the one and only George Gray, the Great Akeem / One Man Gang, depends on who your preference is. Many people love the gang. I always loved Akeem. Very sad in the fall of 90, and very sad when he didn't show up at Survivor Series. Broke my heart. So be sure to check out everything at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Check out all of our feeds on iTunes. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. And you can reach out to us there with feedback, with questions, with mailbag letters for Parv and the chap called Alan. And I'm going to toss it back to them. And I'm Justin Rosero. We'll talk to you next week.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Rosero. You've been paid yet, Alan?
No, I'm still waiting for that. So hopefully my check's in the mail, JT. I do check every day. You know, I'm still holding out for it. So JT, don't let me down.
he's like the Paul Heyman of wrestling podcast.
Yeah, promising CEO. Us the world and, you know, saying, you know, this, that and the other. Come on, JT, you know, come through with the goods.
Okay, well, what's this week's long question from a listener? And I think this is the one that won the Twitter poll that I put up a few weeks ago. So
yes, this one just eked out the other two on this one, and it's Dear Alan and Parv, I'd love to hear some discussion about the use of music in WWF from 1985 to 93. At the beginning, having music made a wrestler stand out. By the end of that period, anyone without music seemed really weird, and that's from Big Bad Mick on Pro Wrestling Only. So thanks for the question, Big Bad Mick. So what do we make of the kind of the whole music with WWF? It's a really interesting kind of topic we've got here, isn't it, Parv?
Yeah, and it took a while to figure out exactly how we were going to go about this. But one of the things that I got interested in is exactly when did they start using music in the WWF? Did you find anything on that question, Alan? Or when was the kind of first uses of music?
Well, the first kind of hinted use of music, I know you watched some stuff from this era that WWF actually used. I mean, there was Gorgeous George, you know, who was, you know, argued as the first person to have music in general in wrestling, which was the Pomp and Circumstance Randy Savage theme, you know, in the 50s. But the first person really that I could kind of see from my research was actually Sergeant Slaughter, who came out to, what was the song called, Parv?
It was called
Marine's Hymn,
and it's got another name as well. Halls of Montezuma, that's the one, yes.
And that was in the late 70s at select MSG shows, apparently.
Yes, and I did see that a couple of times, and there was, I'm sure there's one time where he actually brought, that there was actually a band that came out with him that I saw, but he wouldn't consistently use that. It's not like it was his theme tune, you know. And I'm sure I've seen times where he's basically just comes out with a Grand Wizard as any other wrestler would at that time, with no music. So it's not like, even though that was used, it's not like it was consistently used every single time you saw him as I don't know, the Rock's theme hits every time you see the Rock, for example. So it wasn't quite like that. And of course, at that time you have quite a lot of variation between like MSG and Philly and TV. You know, maybe it was a couple of MSG shows that you saw that, but they wouldn't do it at Philly, for example. So that was that. The next one that I found was Superstar Billy Graham, Alan, in 1982. Now, I have to say, we've been watching this on Titans of Wrestling recently, and I don't remember this happening. But apparently, Graham came out to Eye of the Tiger during this 92 run, 82 run, which is interesting, because, of course, this was right around the time that Hogan would have been going off to, you know, he probably would have gone off to already to film Rocky III at this time. So, yeah, Graham there, head of the bell curve on Hogan, you know, for not the first time in his career, because you could argue that Graham was the kind of a prototype Hogan in the first place.
Completely. You know, that's another, you know, kind of topic, but completely. I think Billy Graham having Eye of the Tiger kind of suited him at the time. I thought that worked, and I think this started a trend for people using, at the time, actual, you know, songs, not in-house produced things that we'd see later on.
Now, some of my other co-hosts here, I'm thinking especially of Pete from Titans of Wrestling, would be very angry with us if we didn't mention the Freebirds at some point. I know he's a big Texas guy. He lives there in Austin. I mean, the Freebirds typically are the ones who are given a lot of credit for bringing music into wrestling quite a lot, aren't they, Alan?
Yeah, I mean, there's footage that I've been watching recently that Chris Zellner, who's one of the hosts on the feed who does Between the Sheets, he kindly put up some Georgia stuff from 81. And the Freebirds, when they're coming out for interviews with Gordon Solie in the studio, you've always got, you know, their, you know, Freebird playing by Leonard Skinner in the background all the time. Every single appearance, they really push that song association with the Freebird, which I thought was quite interesting. And at the time, it was unique, really, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and in fact, I mentioned Titans of Wrestling, but back on episode 29, I think it was, we spent a whole episode on the Freebirds in Georgia, where we talk extensively about that run, and what would happen is that, it's quite unusual to watch now, but Michael Hayes would actually give a whole promo with Freebird playing in the background, with Gordon Solie standing there looking like he's from a different century, basically. So, but basically, back to WWF land for a second. Vince's use of music really started in, and I think you can really pinpoint it, in January of 1991. It's almost like January of 1991 is the trigger for his vision. We've talked about this before, haven't we, about how the product kind of changes in 1984. Mm-hmm. And you can pinpoint the moment. Championship Wrestling, January 1994, has all new credits. Okay,
January 84, yeah.
January 84 has all new credits, okay? The old credits were always this kind of jazzy music that would play. It's quite a cool jazz theme, and they'd had that for going back into the 70s, that same theme. But in Jan of 84, all of a sudden it's a new credit sequence with Hogan very, very, very prominently featured in the credits, and Michael Jackson's Thriller plays. Have you seen those credits? I'm sure you've come across them at some point.
Oh, yeah, I've seen them quite a few times. And I think it was the start of a successful relationship that WWF at the time had with music and the music industry, you know, out throughout 84 and 85. You know, getting licensed to use one of the biggest songs of all time, off one of the biggest albums of all time, that was completely white hot at the time, really, you know, was a really good coup, I think, for idea for Vince to do that.
I mean, we're not entirely sure, actually, whether he paid for that. over on All Star, he was also playing David Bowie's Modern Love, which I actually think, I mean, okay, as a Bowie fan, I can say, well, Let's Dance is his most commercial album. But still, for a wrestling show in 1984 to be playing a Bowie song, it just feels a little bit cut, you know, it's quite cut on the cutting edge of things.
I think it worked, and I think they, on prime time as well, they used something, didn't they, Paul?
Yeah, it was the Pointer Sisters' Jump, which is a really funky song, and I mean, there were a few others as well that later on Saturday Night's Main Event, they played Obsession by An Emotion. That's a really cool song as well.
I love that song.
It's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, it's on my Spotify playlist, that one.
And yeah, there's one other one, which I think was basically a Bonnie Tyler cover of one of Hulk Hogan's theme songs that they later played on the Hogan cartoon.
Ravishing by Bonnie Tyler. It was worth checking out because the version, she's got lyrics on it, but the version we heard was just the instrumental, wasn't it, Parv?
Absolutely.
But the other one, on Saturday Night's Main Event, they had the outro, didn't they, as well as the intro music. And the outro music was Phil Collins' Take Me Home.
That's right. I mean, I guess Phil Collins not quite as cool as some of the other artists we've been mentioning here, but, I mean, still... you know, it's still a world away from the sorts of music that you'd imagine cropping up in wrestling before this point, you know. So so that's, I guess, the general presentation. He brought music in, that Vince did, in a very kind of visible way. And alongside this, you get Hogan featured very prominently. You get Mean Gene all of a sudden on the TV as well. And it's like... You know, it's like pressing go on the Vince McMahon era, the Vince Jr. era. So alongside this, you also then get various different wrestlers coming out to mainstream hits of the day. I guess Hogan is the most prominent one, and that would be Eye of the Tiger again. I'm guessing, you know, most fans wouldn't remember the Billy Graham association. And, of course, Hogan had the Rocky connection as well. The Freebirds themselves were around in 1984 for a cup of coffee, basically. But they did use Freebird when they were there in WWF. I guess it's a blink and you miss them run. Do you remember the Freebirds?
Yeah, they had one MSG show, I think, and things fell apart after that, and they didn't come back. But they used Freebird on that show. We also had like JYD using Another One Bites the Dust, which I think suited his character really well at the time.
Yeah, and he'd been using that in Mid-South, Another One Bites the Dust, but he brought that over, and I actually think it was a big part of his appeal, that, you know, it was a part of his character, really, that song. Of course, there was the Lauper, Cyndi Lauper. I mean, we talked about this on previous shows, the Lou Albano deal, and Wendy Richter, of course, came out too. Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And that was a huge deal at the time.
Oh, massive. I mean, people forget, I mean, or people who aren't around don't realise that Cyndi Lauper in 84, 85 was a megastar, was absolutely huge. And, you know, to have her tied into wrestling at the time, you know, was massive. And people kind of don't realise how big she was.
Yeah, and just to illustrate that, I actually randomly a few weeks back went, I mean, my girlfriend, her sister is a little bit older. So she was born in, I guess, the mid-70s. And she just happened to, my girlfriend just happened, who's, I don't need to know her name, but she happened to show me up into their attic. They've got like one of these attics where, in her parents' house, where you can just kind of go in and, you know, it's not really a room, but it's an attic that you can kind of have a look around in. And basically her sister used to use this as a kind of like a den, like a study. So if you go in there, it's like a time warp back to the mid-80s of all of the, and she's still got the posters on the wall of all of the people that she really loved. And of course, you know, Madonna is there, as you'd imagine. But the person who really seemed prominent to me was Cyndi Lauper. She was absolutely everywhere on posters on her wall. So, I mean, just a little illustration of how over, I guess, Lauper was with just, you know, normal girls at that time. Because that's a whole different audience to, you know,
tap into,
to expose to wrestling at that time. So, yes. Anyone else use mainstream songs? Let's have a look.
Yeah, we had Barry Windham and Mike Rotunda, who are the US Express, had Born in the USA by, you know, the Boss, Bruce Springsteen. And they also, some people know this, some people don't, but they actually were the first people to use the Real American theme,
yeah,
weren't they?
No, they were. That's Hulk Hogan, you know, the theme that we now know as Hulk Hogan's theme tune was originally, I think, for the US Express. Any others? Oh, yes. The Ricky Steamboat, Alan Parsons Project, Cyrus. I mean, if you want to talk about all-time coolest themes, that one, Cyrus for Steamboat, is just absolutely tremendous.
Yeah, he uses it, WrestleMania 3 comes out to it there. It's such a good theme, just a good song in general. I really recommend anyone who's not heard it is just check out Alan Parsons Project, Cyrus. It's awesome. But we also had Piper's Pit. They had their own, or that segment had its own theme, didn't it? It was Owner of a Lonely Heart by Yes.
Yep. There was that. And we talked about Piper's Pit a few weeks ago, and that was, you know, every single part of the show really had, it was plugging into the kind of mainstream culture in this way. And then there's a couple of others that people might not remember so well. Adrian Adonis, Carly Simon's You're So Vain. And apparently, I mean, I haven't actually seen this. This was just came up in the research. But apparently when he came out, Vince actually referenced it. He said something on commentary like, "You're so vain, give me a break," type thing. So it's kind of, that was interesting. And then, when you mentioned that last one, Alan?
The last one, Dream Team, they had the theme, "We Are the Champions" by Queen. I don't remember this one at all. I don't know if you do, Paul.
No, not at all. And it's just occurred to me that "We Are the Champions" is the theme tune to another show here on the net, on the PWO PTBM feed, Tag Team's Back Again, hosted by my friend Kelly. And We Are the Champions is the theme on there, and I'm actually wondering if that's a little inside joke by Kelly there, that because they talk about the Dream Team quite a lot, and maybe that's the reason. So
very clever if it is, Kelly. So after this period, though, we'd frame this as 84 to about 86, wouldn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things to remember about this time is that those guys that we mentioned there, as Big Bad Mitz said in his initial question, they were the exception. Rather than, I mean, I'd say 80% of everybody else, everybody else who we didn't name there, basically didn't have a theme tune.
Maybe Randy Savage might be the only exception.
Yes, I think Savage always had the pomp and circumstance, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was getting a push from the get-go when he was came in, so I think they used it straight away. But from that period, after that, we would move to, say, 87 period on. Or say, after 87, because I know in 87, Ricky Steamboat still had the Alan Parsons Project theme. And so after that, we'd say about 88, would we say it's fair that we went more in-house?
Well, I think what happens is that, and I couldn't get an official answer on this, but it seems to me that Vince wasn't paying for any of this stuff, but he did start to get maybe threatening lawsuits. People saying, well, you're going to have to start paying royalties for this stuff. And then it's not long after that that we seem to see these more mainstream songs slip away from the product. It actually happens quite early on. Like, it happens even by 85, 86, you start to see more in-house stuff coming in. What's the chap's name, Jim Johnson?
Well, it's Jim Johnson, and also people forget Jimmy Hart as well. And this is a little game I want to play with you, Parv, which we're going to have. Okay. Is it Johnson or is it Hart?
Okay.
You know, I'm going to read out some wrestlers and their themes, and I want you to guess who you think actually was the writer or composer or whoever was the brains behind it.
Sounds good.
So, right, we'll start with Jimmy Snuka with a Superfly theme. Do you think that was Jim Johnson or Hart?
Let's go with Jimmy Hart.
You're wrong, it was Jim Johnson.
No.
So the next one, Jake the Snake Roberts, which was the Snake in the Grass theme, which was his kind of most famous theme. Not the one that came later where he said, "Trust me." The kind of, I don't know how to describe it really, what the sound was, but it was a very cool 80s sounding theme anyway.
Brilliant theme. Let's go Johnson.
Yes, well done. Ultimate Warrior Wildfire.
I'd imagine that was Johnson too.
Yeah. Dusty Rhodes, Common Man Boogie.
Got to be Jimmy Hart.
Oh yeah, Jimmy Hart's fingerprints is all over that. Anything with the word boogie in. Hulk Hogan's Real American, that was by neither of them actually, that was by Rick Derringer, wasn't it? Which was, it was a song on its own right before the US Express got it. Big Boss Man, Serving Hard Time.
Gotta be Jimmy Hart.
Yeah. I think you're getting a kind of vibe on who does what now.
I just think Jimmy Hart, it tends towards the lyrics, the actual songs more, and Johnson's more of a kind of mood guy. That's my feeling.
Well, we'll see how you get on then with that theory through the rest of them. We'll quickly go through them. We've got Axel Jim Duggan with the Ho Hustle.
The Ho Hustle. is that his standard?
That's the name of the theme, the Ho Hustle.
Okay. Let's go Johnson.
Yeah. This one's pretty easy. Rhythm and Blues, Hunka Hunka Honky Love.
Wasn't that by Honky Tonk Man himself?
Well,
Jimmy Hart,
yeah. And J.J. Maguire is also credited on that one. We've got Demolition Days.
Gotta be Johnson.
No, you're wrong. Ooh. It's actually Jimmy Hart, J.J. Maguire, and Rick Derringer.
Oh.
So Rick Derringer, you know, is still being used to, and that's a pretty cool theme, to be fair.
Yeah.
When you say the Demolition one.
Classic.
The Rockers, Rockin' Rockers, it's called.
It's got to be Johnson.
No, it's Jimmy Hart.
No.
The Bushwhackers with the Bushwhacker Boogie.
It's got to be Jimmy Hart.
No, it's Johnson. Texas Tornado, Tornado Warning.
God, Johnson.
Yes. Legion of Doom, What a Rush.
Got to be Johnson.
No, Jimmy Hart.
God. Jimmy had a finger in a lot of pies. Okay.
The Nasty Boys, Nasticized.
I'm going to say Hart because he was mates with Hogan and the Nasties.
Yeah, I'll give you that one. It was Jimmy Hart. The Million Dollar Man with the Million Dollar Rap.
Is that what it's called, the Million Dollar Rap?
Yeah.
Johnson.
No, Jimmy Hart.
Jimmy Hart wrote that?
Yeah. The Natural Disasters with the Quaker Shake.
That's just the earthquake noise, isn't it? Johnson.
No, it's Jimmy.
Oh my God.
We've got Papa Shango with the Shango Tango.
Jimmy Hart?
No.
Terrible run.
Finally, we've got the two famous ones here. Bret Hart with Heartbeat.
Jimmy Hart?
Yes, with a screeching guitar. And Shawn Michaels with Sexy Boy.
That was just Sherry, wasn't it?
No, it was
Jimmy Hart.
It was Jimmy Hart.
Ah.
So Well, now, Parv, there, you did middle of the road. I think you got 50% of those right. So it's quite shocking. It proves my point that Jimmy Hart had a lot more influence in, onto the WWF music as he moved on into the late 80s, into the 90s.
He wrote a lot of them, didn't he?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really quite surprising that there's just so many of them. Because, you know, you think that he helps out here and there, but it's mainly Johnson. That would be my thought, but clearly Jimmy... was that
Jimmy at that era, and then when Jimmy Hart kind of left in 93, he moved on to Johnson doing a lot. I mean, Jim Johnson was featured in the Beyond the Mats, I think, documentary when he's putting together Vader's music.
Did he then go on and do WCW themes then, Jimmy Hart?
No, Jimmy Hart, God, yeah, he's all over WCW themes. If you check out WCW in 94, 95, I would say one in every two themes is a Jimmy Hart one. I mean, even the cover themes, you know, that have, you know, where DDP had and people like that, they were Jimmy Hart penned ones.
Great, but he didn't write for my money, the best non-WWF theme of all time, possibly even the best theme ever, which is the Too Cold Scorpio one, because he would have.
No,
been,
we didn't do that one. No, you know what I thought you were going to say then? I thought you were going to say, ironically, the American Males theme.
No.
I don't know if you've heard that ever, Parv. You will get to hear it on a future Where the Big Boys Play show. Now, that's a theme and a half. But yeah, I mean, my favourite themes, I know you touched on, you know, that being one of yours. I mean, my favourite themes in wrestling were the Demolition one, which you mentioned, the Rougeau Brothers one. I don't know if
I know it. Yeah, decent theme.
Yeah, that's a Jimmy Hart one. That one, and both of Rick Rude's famous WWF and WCW themes. I mean, if those two themes had a fight, I honestly don't know who would win. He managed to get both the companies to bring their A game, you know, to make those themes.
Sleazy kind of saxophone music. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, the other good saxophone music I know we're getting out of WWF at the moment was the Doom theme.
Oh, yeah, no, Doom had a decent theme, absolutely.
Saxophone, a dirty saxophone theme. But, yeah, they're some of the themes. I don't know about you, Parv. Is there anyone else that you liked in this time?
I mean, I've always had a soft spot randomly for Pineapple Crush's theme. I know it wasn't a great run, but I love that theme, especially the version that used to come on the SNES game, the WWF Royal Rumble.
No, that's the one I remember it from, because I don't really remember it as much on TV than I did, because I played that game a lot around that period as well.
Sid had a decent theme around that time as well, like along the same, just really good riffs, you know, on those ones. Mr. Perfect's music was cool.
Yeah, fit the character well, didn't it? Just
yeah, those would be the ones that I'd think about. That's the era of really classic themes. I think if anybody was playing like Name That Theme song, most of them would come from this era, in my view.
Oh no, definitely, and I think that kind of ties in all together to kind of the era from the mid-80s, which was more the actual songs to the in-house stuff from Jimmy Hart and Jim Johnson. I don't know, have you got anything else to add to answer to Big Bad Mick on this one?
Well, just one other thing I wanted to say, Alan, was about... So not so much the theme tunes, but the use of music on... So we mentioned, you know, some of the changes Vince made in 84, but some of the other music that was played, you know, like the WrestleMania theme or the SummerSlam music or some of the music on the Coliseum tapes. Do you have any memories of any of those themes?
Well, yeah, I mean, they had the WrestleMania theme, you know, I think it was 92 or 93 that, you know, that was most famous. And they used that for years as the WrestleMania theme. And then later on, it was used as Linda McMahon's theme on TV whenever she came out. She had the stock generic WrestleMania theme. But that whole era was quite interesting. I mean, this was 93 when the WWF was still huge over here in the UK. And once Simon Cowell took advantage of that, because he linked in with the WWF to release the WWF singles here in the UK. Hacksaw Jim Duggan had one that charted. I don't know if you remember that, Parv. We had the WrestleMania kind of rap, not the Mabel and Mo one. It was more...
Or Run DMC's one.
Yeah, not that one either. It was more kind of, I don't know, it wasn't very good, but around that area we had quite, you know, two or three actual released singles into the UK charts of wrestlers singing over the top of, you know, very rubbish composed music.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's something else that we haven't actually mentioned is all of the various different albums they brought out, like the wrestling album in 85, the Piledriver
album in 80, was it
86, I want to say.
86, 87 time, yeah, I mean... Which is the Coco Beware theme.
Yeah. I want to say that it's those it's actually those records that they started bringing out that kind of started giving more and more people theme tunes, or maybe got the like gave Vince the idea that everybody now needs a theme tune. Because I mean, I think like you think in 1988 when let's say somebody who comes in with a major push, DiBiase for example, comes in 88 with a major push, no music at all, perfect, no music. I think Rude always had his music because he was doing that deal, you know, in the territories and elsewhere. But you know, Andre still, I mean, I don't think Andre ever had music, did he? Did he ever have?
No, I don't think he had music. If he did, it was sinister sounding music. I don't know. Yeah. I've got a vague memory of that maybe, or that might have been used on one of the video games, actually, now come to think of it.
But I mean, apart from those couple of exceptions, most people by 1989-90 had music, you know.
Unless you were Bob Backlund in 93.
Bob Backlund in 93 didn't. IRS never had music, despite the lies of Sega and Nintendo.
All that typing thing.
Yeah. I mean, that was, he came out cutting promos about tax laws and things. And I want to say the Brainbusters didn't have music in 89. But apart from them, I think basically everybody had music by at least 1990.
I think the, you know, you didn't have your jobber to the stars types. I don't think they would have music.
Buddy Rose wouldn't have had music when he was doing that jobber run, for example. But
I mean, because on TV they were introduced in the ring all times, weren't they? So they weren't really given an entrance that needed
music.
They
were already in the ring. I want to say Dino Bravo never had a theme.
Well, if it did, it would have been really shit to match him, wouldn't it? It would have been French-Canadian type. The may have been the Quebec anthem.
Maybe he did have something like that.
Yeah, that would have probably, you know, well, tied into his character.
If you can remember any other guys who never had themes after about 1990, write in and tell us.
Yeah, because the only one I can think of anyone that was kind of pushed to some degree was, like I said, Bob Backlund in 93. But that fitted his character to me. You know, just this geek, this pale geek who came out, you know, I mean, in 93 I had no idea that Bob Backlund was the champion in, you know, 10 years previous. It just, this guy with kind of off copper hair, I just thought, with a towel around your neck, what are you doing, pal? It wasn't for me, and I think not having music kind of made me think even worse of him, so it definitely didn't help him, did it?
It's always been my dream to run 93 Backlund in like today's wrestling. Like in, I mean, like 2016, or you know, go into like a proper, you know, indie promotion with that, or even on like WWE TV with 93 Backlund against whoever. I just think that would be so much fun. So, yes. Okay. Well, I think it's time, Alan, to debut a feature that we've been talking about for a little bit now, which is the WWF magazine recap.
The new World Wrestling Federation magazine is now on sale. All this and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine, on sale this Tuesday at your local newsstand.
Yeah, we're delving into the archives here, aren't we, Paul?
Yeah, and we're going to see if we can actually find a way of sharing each of these issues of the magazine that we're going to mention. And every week, basically, one of us is going to pick a story that we're going to just read a little bit of something that happened. And I picked one from May of 1991 this week. And if you go over to page 14 of that, there's a little story about, it's called Personality Profile, Greg the Hammer Valentine. And I just thought this would be a neat tie-in to the Mariner stuff that we talked about earlier, Alan, where Greg Valentine was having this feud with Jimmy Hart. Basically, he talks about how he no longer associates himself with the manager, the Mouth of the South, and his band of cutthroats. Greg the Hammer Valentine is riding a new wave of success in the WWF. This is apparently what Greg says. He says, "I'm through with Jimmy Hart. After all these years, I finally find out what he is, and that's a runt who makes people do things just for his own sake. I'm going to get him and whoever he chooses to throw at me." Valentine has other reasons for parting company with the Mouth and his henchmen. doing a bout at Madison Square Garden, for example, he held his back, he held back his foe's arms so that the mouth could strike the adversary over the head with a folding chair. Just before Hart brought the chair down, however, the opponent moved, allowing the metal object to crack across the hammer's brow. As a result of this booby trap gone awry, Valentine, so he says, has learned some important lessons. He learned that Jimmy Hart, for one, is a man who can't be trusted. Furthermore, he learned that engaging in such ruthless and unsportsmanlike activities didn't do anything to further his career as an athlete. All that he got out of the incident, the hammer claims, was a lump on his head and a painful memory that crime doesn't pay. I mean, I'll stop reading there, but he basically goes on to say that he's had some matches with Dino Bravo and that now he's set his sights on Jimmy Hart's main charge, Earthquake. And I thought this was an interesting little bit. As a good portion of the universe knows, these two superstars collided at WrestleMania 7, although this article was penned some weeks prior to that star-studded extravaganza in Los Angeles, California. So what you were saying before about the magazine coming out kind of after the event, in evidence here.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on this little article about Craig Valentine and Jimmy Hart?
Well, he thought crime doesn't pay. And he's going on to be, you know, not a rule breaker anymore. What success did Greg Valentine have as a face in the WWF after 1991? None at all. I mean, in the 80s, he was tag team champion, IC champion, and that was all as a heel. As a face, he had nothing memorable going on. He was rubbish. So, to be honest, he's got his whole ideal, what he wants to do is completely skew. He needs to be a heel still. That's where he gets his success from, and he's an idiot for thinking otherwise.
Well, at WrestleMania, he wanted to dispel Earthquake's aura of invincibility and at the same time eliminate Jimmy Hart's biggest star. So there we go. That's our WWF magazine recap for the week. If people want to get hold of us to write in for the mailbag, or maybe you've got a particular WF magazine article that you've got fond memories of that we could take a look at, how could they do so, Alan?
Well, the best way to get hold of us is on Twitter. So you can reach out to us. I'm at Alan_Cheapshot. That's spelled Allan_Cheapshot. And how do we get yourself on Twitter, Parv?
I'm at Jerry Von K.
And you can also check us out and send questions into your Place to Be Nation email, can't we, Parv?
yeah, in theory.
Have you checked it yet?
No, I can't remember what the password is, so that makes it rather difficult. Maybe I'll see if Justin can unlock that for me in a few weeks, maybe. There's also
I hope he unlocks that, because he doesn't unlock his wallet, does he?
There's also the Facebook, of course, the PWO PTBN Facebook page where the show will be posted. And also the Pro Wrestling Only board. So those are the main ways of getting in touch with us.
Yeah, so I just want to thank everyone for listening to another great episode of the show. Parv, you got anything else to add before we get out of here?
No, see you next week.
Adios.
Watch us feast on 400 pounds of white meat known as King Kong Bundy.